Welcome to Hot Plate, a post-foodie podcast. I'm your host, Joshna Maharaj. Today on Hot Plate, cooking with Zooming grandmas, comfort versus nostalgia, the Korean kimchi crisis, and the state of plants and fungi today. Welcome back. Thanks for listening. Welcome, Laura. We're here. Well, we're happy to have you here for the second week as our guest host.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
So for our listeners, we have wonderful guest host. Laura Brejo is a food reporter for the National Post. She earned a culinary arts certificate and professional fromager certificate from George Brown College. Laura graduated with a BA honors from Ryerson University's RTA School of Media and a BA in linguistics and anthropology from the University of Victoria. She has an interest in the cultural significance of food and foodways and believes in the importance of building culinary skills and access to healthful food for all. Thanks. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you so much.
These are some very exciting things that we're going to talk about today. These are some of my favorite things, and those connect to sort of the overlap between cooking and tradition and a little bit of political resistance, just for good measure. So the first bit that I'm bringing to the conversation is this program called Grandma's Hands. And this is a wonderful program that is alive in the U.S., where essentially Black grandmothers are feeding their communities while passing on food traditions via Zoom calls online. And that is like the clash of all of these things together got me super, super excited, right? Anchored in a need to teach young people how to cook traditional foods, but also just there's a food security angle on all of this. And then there's just the sweetness of grandmothers in Zoom calls, which I found so, so lovely. But particularly at this sort of socio-political moment where Black American stories and tradition and heritage are really being solicited and given some light for, in many, many cases, for the first time ever. I was really into this because I myself am a bit worried about the generation that is passing without their knowledge being kept and appreciated this way. Have you heard or seen about other things like this, or how does this hit you?
Well, I think this is really beautiful, and I think the one thing that kind of struck me about Grandma's Hands in particular is just that it's, you know, a way of sharing knowledge with another, with a younger generation, right. But it's also about creating a space, just for conversations around food and cooking, yeah. As well as you said, you know, food security and in a sense, educating about, the food system as well by connecting these people to farmers in the local area. So I think it's this amazing combination of a lot of different things happening.
Right. I actually went to the website to see about how I could sign on.
Oh, nice.
To watch one, because it would be such a treat to watch it and to make that connection. There was for a while, and I think maybe she may still be there, a nonna on YouTube who was teaching people how to make pasta.
Right.
I don't know if this was just a pandemic lockdown thing or if this was before then, but I really, really appreciated that. And her sweet old hands that have the memory about how to fold all those little tiny bits of pasta was just amazing.
And you know what this actually reminded me of too, is a new book that I have. It's called In Bibi's Kitchen by Hawa Hassan.
Okay.
And she focuses on 8 African countries that touch the Indian Ocean. But really at the heart of it are grandmothers, Bibis. And so she highlights these grandmothers in each of these countries. You know, sometimes, you know, they've been forced to flee. And so really all over the world, and how she connected with these women was also over, you know, Zoom calls or FaceTimes, They showed her how to make these dishes. And so the book is really a collection of these Bibis, these grandmothers' dishes, but as well their stories in their own words. And it's all about family and connection and community. And one thing Hawa, the author, also points out is that the voices of these matriarchs, they're so often missing from conversations, right, about food.
Yep. That's a really important thing. It's like an undocumented history, right? Because we don't hear from them. We don't know this. And now that they are old, old, old ladies, the effort to harness this is super, super important. I was super delighted about this. And the intergenerational play is something that feels really important. And we're not, I don't know, man, we're not going to grow and make great decisions for the future if we have such, I believe, right? If we have such a severed connection to what our past was all about. It makes me think about finding all the old Indian aunties around the place and starting to get their biryani recipes or, you know, and really and mine all of that, because that wealth is something that would just break, it can't die with them, right? And we have to figure a way to put that together, because I know what it's like. Just this past weekend, I made some stuffing. With my mother was here visiting me, and we made this stuffing that her mother actually made. And it's one of the very few recipes that we have, and hilarious that it's stuffing that is this, you know. And there's also a shortbread recipe like this, which is super funny because it's a more sort of hilarious nod to our deep colonial roots with my South African Indian family. But it was, I got to hear stories about how my mom puts way more butter in there than her mother put in, because, you know, that's how she liked it. Or she remembered hearing the sounds of this and, you know, around Thanksgiving time. And it was the first mashed potatoes are involved in this stuffing. But now there's no other moment where those stories emerge, you know?
And what do you think about that? Just the oral transmission of recipes versus, right? There's something so special and unique about it.
Definitely. It is, because what I have learned is that it is, all of my other senses are involved in my understanding of, you know, because you don't write, I can't write down on a piece of paper, cooking till it smells right. Right. I can't, that's not there. Or you want to wait for the sound of something to pop and sneeze, you know, or hiss in the oven. Right. Or it's just the fact that the sound of the three bangs of the spoon on the side with my mom's gold bangle involved in all of that is just a really, that takes me back to a certain place in a certain time. And these are things that you can't, unfortunately, lock on a page.
So by this point, you know, almost 9 months into the pandemic, you know, comfort, the idea of comfort food, comfort eating is, you know, we're pretty comfortable in that.
We're in that groove. Yeah.
We know what we're doing.
Yeah.
But I did start thinking about this whole concept of eating nostalgically and what it really brings us. And also, is it possible to kind of recapture, the feelings that these foods gave us when we were a kid, that say that we have a comfort food that we really associate with a certain time in our lives. Mm-hmm. And it all kind of stemmed from General Mills, who announced that they were returning to these 80s cereal recipes, these retro. So, you know, high sugar, no messing around with the artificial colors and this and that, right? Like, throwback, 100%.
Oh, so we're talking like alphabets kind of.
Well, they're going right back to the 80s taste. Cocoa Puffs, Golden Grahams, Cookie Crisp, and Trix.
Trix.
And so there's apparently trying to kind of woo millennials back to eating cereal, essentially. Yes. And so it really made me think, like, as adults, you know, would a bowl of Cocoa Puffs really please us in the way that it did, you know, on that Saturday morning, you're pouring your cereal, you're sitting down, you're eating it in front of the TV.
Cartoons. Yep.
Yeah.
There, I wondered the same thing. And in fact, just recently I found myself with a box of Fruit Loops.
You didn't.
I did. And I was like, I wonder if this is the same feeling.
What happened?
And one of the most similar experiences was the feeling of the scrape on the roof of your mouth when you don't let it get soggy enough and you dive right in a bit too early, perhaps. That happened again, and that was a funny remembrance. But I started thinking about eating this, and my family, Fruit Loops was never a thing. That was like, we would have it once when we went camping, but that was, there's no reason at all where that was an everyday thing.
Same.
Never. But it, and then the other piece that I connected to was the sweet milk right? The few slurps of sweet milk at the end, that was a sort of nice memory. And remembering younger versions of me that had to learn about the right level of balance and tilt on the bowl so that I didn't end up wearing it, right? Because it was breakfast, then you had already changed into the clothes you were going to wear to school, you know, and so there's no time to stop and go and deal with all of that. I remembered that. But then, to your point, I am a child of the 80s. I was a little elementary school kid in the 80s, and the breakfast cereal was ubiquitous. I don't know. I couldn't tell you anybody that didn't eat milk and cereal for breakfast when I was a kid.
And a snack, right? A snack, yeah, after school.
Totally. And a bowl of cereal was sort of like a freebie, like the fruit bowl, right? It was like you could always, there was all that was always in the house was the capacity to have a bowl of cereal. And then to think about the Saturday morning of it all, I can remember my parents realizing that extra sleep was available to them if they didn't have to come downstairs and pour milk in our cereal. So they, at a very early age, gave my brother and I tutorials on how to pour ourselves cereal and to deal with the bag of milk and to deal with the freshie, you know, to hold the top back a little on the brand new so that we wouldn't have an ocean of milk on the all over the floor. And they put everything on the low shelf so my little brother could also reach it and get himself a bowl, because that was, we all got a freebie. They got extra sleep and we got to sit in front of the television with food, which at that time in my family was not a thing. Eating in front of the television was absolutely not a thing we did, save the 1 or 2 hours on Saturday morning where we got this free bit.
I think like the nostalgia of it, I think maybe more so in actually eating it again, is you tapped into it there. You reminded me with the cereal milk, right? Like just what Christina Tosi, yes, has done with that concept, right? So just like a glimmer of a reminder of it, but not the actual replication of it, right? Like just taking, yes, it and running with it.
Yep, that's exactly it. But I really appreciated the distinction here between the idea of comfort eating and nostalgic eating. Right? Because the comfort is more like, the comfort is now, right? I'm not feeling good now. I need something like cookies or starch or pizza or whatever to make me feel better now. Whereas the nostalgia is always a bit of a nod to before.
Yes.
Right? Yes. It's of how things to evoke what once was, in order to try and bring it back. And that I hadn't really understood that we are perhaps doing both of those things right now.
Right.
That this crazy moment is actually our urges and our leanings are in both of those directions.
I like that
idea.
Simpler times, easier times for us, right? As kids, like kind, yes, of a reminder of that. What do you think? Like, do you think that it's possible to go home again in terms of eating those foods in their state and enjoying them in the same way?
I don't. Because the other truth is that I have changed.
Totally.
Right. I remember recently having a bite of a Pop-Tart and I can remember enjoying those things as a kid, but the cook inside of me was like, my God, that pastry, that's, you know what I mean? That flat, stodgy, nothing pastry, yeah, because I have, you know what I mean? I've since the last time I ate Pop-Tarts, I've gone to cooking school. Right. And I've become a professional cook. So things have changed and I was disappointed, right? I was disappointed that I tasted that thing and I was like, yeah, oh.
Yeah, you almost wish you hadn't, right? Exactly. You could stay intact.
Because I think, right, I think you are right. I don't think you can go back
and
recreate it. I think you are lucky if you can remember it and, yes, that you can get a few glimpses that remind you of it.
Okay, and so I think that one thing that's been happening too with the comfort food and kind of nostalgic eating is obviously the pandemic, but I think that a lot of things that have been coming out now, like I'm thinking about Ina Garten's,
yes,
new book.
Oh, let's talk about this. Yes.
Right. Modern comfort foods. So, I mean, she's like, it seems prescient, you know, but she was just expecting that it would be a stressful time for people because of the US election. So thinking, oh, people are going to be looking for comfort, but not realizing obviously at the time to what degree people would be looking for that comfort.
Yeah. Yep.
So it ends up being more relevant than ever. But what I thought was cool about this concept is that, so one of her all-time favorite comfort foods is split pea soup from a can that her mom would make her.
Okay.
With cut up hot dogs.
Wow. Did she put it in the book?
Well, what she did is think like, okay, how can I adapt this to suit my taste now, but still get the same sense of warmth and satisfaction?
Oh, good for her. Okay.
So she created the soup from scratch, tons of vegetables, tons of herbs. And then instead of the hot dogs, did just like a sautéed slices of kielbasa.
I was going to ask if it was kielbasa.
Yes.
Sophisticated grown-up version, or maybe chunks of mortadella would have been another thought.
That's right. But like, no more work, right? Because you're just like quickly sautéing it in the pan and then it's already cooked, it's smoked, and just toss it on top. So I loved this idea of taking that really treasured memory and a food memory and just adapt, playing with it. And I just love that creativity of cooks.
Good for her. You know, God bless her. I as a young cook, I was a major, major fan. Desperately still want to go and be a house guest. Right? Because she looks like she's got the dreamiest versions of everything over there. And when I saw this comfort food book, I was a little like, really, Ina? Another comfort? Like, aren't all your cookbooks comfort food books, Ina? For real. I did roll my eyes a little bit about it all.
That's funny.
But then I saw her in that video with that hilariously giant martini glass.
Yeah. She knows how to do it. She knows how to do it.
She really does. And then to hear this piece about this canned soup, this grown-up version, that's compelling. That's very exciting. Thanks for that tip. I will go and find that book because I'm a dedicated fan for sure. But at the same time, I was just like, I need comfort food from you, Ina, that's not just more starch and fat and starch and fat.
Okay, well, this is what I was interested by too, is that there are so many great vegetable recipes in that book.
Right.
There really are. Oh, and
that's lovely to hear.
Yeah, and that's one thing that she was talking about. She was like, yeah, this idea that, you know, you need to treat vegetables with enough love, right? To make them, to kind of make them fit into that comfort category, you know, whether it's making them a little cheesy or giving them a little creaminess.
Crispy bits, yes.
Oh my goodness. But there's an amazing broccoli and kale salad in there that she tops with like a really soft boiled egg, really delicious Caesar dressing, right? So just like taking these really amazing winter vegetables and making them comforting.
I feel like even Ina has not been able to resist the Otolenghi effect. Right? I was just watching his masterclass, and he will spin you into a vegetable-based wonderland.
Oh, that's awesome.
Right? It is so good. My mom and I, our mouths were watering watching this man just handle this food. He really has done something. I love this. I'm going to go chase down this book. Thank you. So Laura, we have a bit of a loose theme today that is about culture and tradition in food. And we've, you know, sort of started talking about passing down tradition and memories, but I'm going to pull us right into the immediate and a story about there not being enough cabbage grown as part of the harvest in Korea this year, and that the kimchi production is being dramatically impacted by this. I felt really five alarm about all of this when I read this piece. And I thought, especially because the piece that I read talked about how climate change is what is affecting the crops like this. And that Napa cabbage, right? That type of cabbage is particularly susceptible to temperature and water, you know, hydration fluctuations, which is why it was the first to go, right? And be hit by the impact of climate change. And that to me got really, really scary. Right? I was like, these are things we don't think about, right? What happens when Korea can't grow enough cabbage to make kimchi? That feels really unsettling to me.
Yeah. And when you think about a practice too, that has so much cultural significance, it's more than just the food. It's everything that it represents.
And it's that moment in time where the whole community comes together.
Yeah.
Right. We even have, there's a name called Kimjang, mm-hmm. is the name, the collective practice of making the kimchi. The fact that everybody does this together. And so that everybody now is suffering because they can't do this.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting too. And when you think about it as well, as a practice that really kind of cements that connection with nature.
Yes.
Right. And then having the reason why the harvest was disrupted this year, you know, be climate change. I mean, it's interesting.
I remember in the spring when the ramps peaked, the green ramps peaked out through the surface, and then asparagus followed, and then the strawberries. I remember thinking to myself, oh, okay, Mother Nature is still doing her thing. Mm. And I was so reassured by that.
Mm-hmm.
And as all the familiar things kept showing up on the tables at the farmer's market, I was like, okay, good. Okay, great. Right. And I honestly believe that this gratitude is part of why we can't get our hands on a mason jar. Right. And I really feel like there was a conscious notion that we all need to lock this up. Right.
Yeah. Preserve
this. Yes, this is it. Right. We don't know what the future will bring, but for goodness sake, there should be good food. So to see, like, I'm just really connecting to my own deep gratitude about the fact that I got to, and, you know, to see that I have a freezer full of strawberry freezer jam and bits of kale from my winter soups are, you know, they're, and my frozen blueberries are patiently waiting for when I really need them. But to think about the fact that our friends in Korea are, you know, are really suffering to make thing, you know, I'm guessing they want to make whatever exists last. As long as it possibly can. And what has that meant to their sense of themselves if this really important thing has not been able to happen this year?
Well, I was even thinking too about the fact that some producers are having to look elsewhere, right? Like potentially to China for cabbage. And I was remembering the chef, Hoonie Kim. I was talking to him about his cookbook, which is called My Korea, but he was talking about just about how he wanted to inspire people to go to Korea. And he was talking about how much the terroir meant to him and how he was like, you have to taste a cabbage in Korea. You have to taste a kimchi made from a cabbage in Korea. He's like, it's like as distinctive as, you know, a specific Burgundy variety of grape or something like that.
Right. Or Italian pomodoro tomato. Yes.
Right. So you think about then what terroir means to people as well. Like, so is that, you know, let's say you have to get cabbage, especially when it's a practice so tied to your land and your season, right?
Yes.
Everything is from around you traditionally, and then you have to go elsewhere. Like, how does that affect the meaning for you as well?
Yep. And for sure, it's like there'll be note in whatever the harvest notes are. It'll be very clearly marked that those were the years of the imported Chinese, you know, those were the years of the Chinese cabbage when this is what we had to make do with because of, I mean, I'm just imagining that we'll get to a point where they will, their cabbage harvest will be restored. But it's, these are sort of really important signals that things are not okay, right?
Yeah.
If fans are having trouble with these stories are all around, right? Even just thinking about like Mexican farmers and hair and corn and what those, you know what I mean? The impact of climate change and obviously NAFTA and capitalism on that corn. What that says to a people who are so defined by this thing that they make and that they eat.
Absolutely. So this issue with Napa cabbage and it being more susceptible to climate change just made me think about this new study that's out of Kew Gardens, the botanical gardens in London, their farm. They just put out a state of the world's plants and fungi report.
Okay.
It really highlights how, because, you know, thinking specifically about kimchi and just the idea that Napa cabbage kimchi is just one type of kimchi that it exists.
Right, right, of course.
There's an estimated 200 different varieties of kimchi, you know, radish, cucumber, mustard leaf, and on and on. But just this idea that we as a planet rely on so few crops.
Mm.
The vast majority of our food comes from only 15 crops.
It's so crazy.
Right? And
it
does make us, so I think what we're seeing here with the story about Napa cabbage and that just being the most recent example of the effect of climate change on our food systems and food security is that there's so much potential out there, and that's what this this study really highlights.
That is interesting. So essentially, if I'm understanding this correctly, the idea being that the fact that we have narrowed our production to just this one type of cabbage, and now, now that the further impact of climate change is in front of us, when we only have one and it gets knocked down, we are in much worse shape.
Yeah, and really what these researchers did, and this is just one part of the study because it's a really massive study, including researchers, hundreds of researchers from many different countries that collaborated on this report. So it's really far-reaching. But the food chapter specifically, the researchers identified thousands of what they termed overlooked and underutilized plants.
Right.
And so really highlighting, and they drew out, I think, nearly 100 of those plants in particular, and they didn't have any sort of algorithm to identify these plants as the plants they identified as having particular potential. They used their own expertise, and because the researchers were from all over the world, I mean, their expertise was so vast in terms of geography as well. But so they came up with this list of almost 100 that they thought they were really multi-purpose plants that held a lot of potential for global food.
Right. And so the idea being that we just reinvest ourselves in cultivating these, and we really could have a major solution to some of these production issues that we're seeing.
Yeah. And it's kind of interesting because one of the ones that they highlighted is something called the marama bean, which is native to the savannas of Southern Africa. And it's widely eaten there in a number of forms. And its flavor is apparently tastes like cashew nuts when it's roasted, but it's like a really big, like chestnut brown, really big, smooth bean, but it can be used. One of the researchers, Tiziana Ulian, explained that, you know, you can get milk from this bean, you can get oil, you can grind it and, you know, use it as a flour for baking. It's really just got so much potential.
Oh, that's, it's really, really, these types of things are really exciting, right? This paired with a commitment around regenerative growing are like, this real positive solutions for, you know, an otherwise really dismal scenario
about right.
Our climate change and our food supply. Things like this have me so hopeful for what, I mean, if we just smarten up and make better choices, what's in front of us is so hopeful.
True. So when you think about the fact that we really have sunk all of our, you know, we've really put everything into just such a small number of crops, and then to think on the flip side, just the biodiversity that's out there, it is really exciting. And these are things too that locally are really used to their maximum potential, right? So it's tapping into that local knowledge,
right?
Those traditions, it's learning from those and then kind of applying that in a global context, because a lot of these underutilized plants, like they are used locally, or maybe they're wild plants that people gather locally, but their profile really hasn't traveled past that local, but they do have potential to be global.
Well, and the cook inside of me is wants to get my hands on these things to start playing around in the kitchen.
No kidding.
And see what they do. Obviously, that learning from the wonderful grassroots traditions that they come from. But if we can sort of zoom out and think about broader applications of this very localized knowledge, I see a perfect opportunity for chefs to start, you know, translating some of this, right? And helping people to make these connections. You know, if we can, you know, if we invest and start producing these crops, we can help with actually making, you know, connecting in a more hopeful, positive version of something like a wartime ration.
Well, what's cool too is like these plants that they identified grow well in harsh conditions, essentially,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
So they're hardy. They would suit climatic changes.
Yes.
But also, I just think that one of them, to give you an example, akub. I've only heard of it in the context of Palestinian cuisine. So it looks like a thistle. It's a really beautiful plant, and it's actually not cultivated. It's collected wild throughout the Eastern Mediterranean and the Middle East. But it's eaten like a vegetable. It can be pickled. It can be, you know, fried in olive oil with garlic, like that kind of thing. Okay. But the one, so that one I had heard of on this list. But the only one I had actually tasted on this list, was pandan leaves.
Yes.
And so thinking about pandan leaf, you know, I've appreciated its ability, its aromatic qualities and in flavoring a dish, but I didn't know it produces, the female plant produces the most gorgeous segmented fruit.
No way. Really?
Yeah. Segmented similar to a pineapple, but I mean, it is stunning. And I had no idea that the female plant produced this fruit. So I just thought it was the leaf, but
ew, okay.
So the potential for that plant as well.
It moments this, oh man, so many times throughout this ordeal of the pandemic, I have really been hit in the face with the truth of the degree to which we as humans have manipulated our food system and our food production, right? To meet our own ends, to the thing that is cheapest and most convenient and most, you know, even down to the nonsense about the fact that not all the cucumbers work because they have to be straight enough to fit into the case, right? Like, it's that degree of control that we have asserted over all of this in the name of success and progress and efficiency and all of this. But look at what we've done, right? So I've had so many moments with the, like, look at what we've done, right? Oh, just to see how the doors that we closed that we don't even realize that we've closed.
Well, and I think in that sense too, the one thing that the researcher stressed about this study as well is that, so they identified these thousands, but she was like, we're finding new plants, new edible plants all the time.
Right.
Right. But then that kind of goes with our awareness, humankind's awareness, right?
Yes.
Of, and our actions in unwilding the world, right? So it's like you have these things happening simultaneously. We're discovering these new varieties. We're identifying these new edible plants, but at the same time, our actions are detrimental, right, to the natural world. So I think it's a really interesting subject to think about right now. And I would encourage listeners to download that report, the state of the world.
Kew Gardens, spelled K-E-W, Garden.
Yeah. So it's
we can post a link on in the show notes for people to find that as well.
Yeah, it's a fascinating. Every year, I enjoy reading it. Well, actually, it's been the last 4 years they've been putting it out, but this is the first time they've combined plants and fungi in a single report. And okay. it's 210 researchers in 42 countries, so it's an amazing read.
It's an exhaustive and trustable too. That's a piece that I really appreciate. Awesome, thank you for that. If you're enjoying our podcast, you can support us at patreon.com/hotplatepod. Hot Plate is part of the Frequency Podcast Network. Please consider leaving us a rating or review. It helps others find us. You can follow me at Joshna Maharaj on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thanks for joining us, Laura. You can find Laura on social media and her handles will be in our show notes. Hot Plate is produced by Mirella Amato and Dennis Coyne with original music by Dave Bell. Thanks for listening.